You're listening to the Cannabis Podcast with Martin and Josie.
Welcome to the Cannabis Podcast. I'm Martin Lane, the co-founder of Cannabis, and joining me today is Chief Correspondent Steve Jones.
Hello.
And legalised cannabis New South Wales MP Jeremy Buckingham. Jeremy, welcome.
Welcome. G'day, fellas.
Jeremy, I want to start with you because obviously there's been big news from New South Wales in recent weeks, and that's the creation of the state's first ever inquiry into the impact of cannabis prohibition, which you'll be chairing. What do you hope the inquiry is going to achieve?
Well, I hope the inquiry achieves the legalisation of the adult use of cannabis in New South Wales and ultimately Australia. That's the end goal. But I see it as a key step in that process of building an understanding of the current regulatory regime, how it exists now, how it does and doesn't work, in my opinion, and what the different models for cannabis legalisation may be and what the outcomes of that may be from a socioeconomic perspective, through to, you know, impacts on our criminal justice system, agriculture, economic development and the like. So it's got a very broad remit to look at a range of issues in the cannabis space, from the historical creation of our current cannabis laws through to where we want to be in the future. And I, as I say, hopefully with the legalisation of an adult cannabis use market and legislation in New South Wales and Australia.
We'll talk a little bit more about how it kind of fits into what else is going on in the kind of regulatory space, I guess. But one of the things that struck me that was interesting is you've been kind of one of the arguments that you've been putting forward in terms of the benefits of legalisation has been around that issue of cutting off revenue that would otherwise flow into the hands of organised crime groups. That's a relatively new argument, I think, that, you know, that you've been pushing. Is that resonating with your fellow MPs and you know, potentially the people on the inquiry committee?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's really caught them off guard, I think. For a long time, drug law reform advocates had made the case around harm reduction and reducing harm by moving to, in some instances, with some drugs, decriminalisation, and with cannabis ending prohibition and moving to legalisation and being able to regulate an industry and reduce harm. But it was falling on deaf ears. There was no political imperative to do that. And, you know, as former journalists, you would know that the maxim still remains in that industry: if it bleeds, it leads. And the papers were absolutely full of stories about Sydney crime syndicates, organised crime, shooting each other, conducting a gangland war over the profits of principally cocaine in New South Wales. They were just splashed over in the papers every day. Of course, the politicians were reacting to it. And so I thought to myself, well, let's drill down into these criminal syndicates. How do they actually operate? And is there an intersection with illicit cannabis? And you don't have to dig very far and you realise that there is. Some of the most senior police at a federal and state level, former AFP commissioners Mick Palmer, Jason Weinstein, who's a senior police officer in New South Wales, have all said that, and Jason Weinstein's case, he has said that illicit cannabis is the rocket fuel of organised crime, creating the sort of base trophic level of their business model, starting up some grow rooms, sending some people up to the north coast to put some tunnels of illicit cannabis in, and then funneling the proceeds of that cannabis into other bad things. So I've been able to make that case to the Premier through the budget estimates in the press. It's caught them off guard because it's true. It's a reason to take the cannabis industry out of the hands of criminals and regulate it. That argument, I don't think, has been made. I made it, and it seems to be having an impact.
It's really interesting because the motion to set up inquiry obviously was passed with support from the government and the Greens, but there's also representatives, I think, on the committee from the shooters and the Liberals. It's according to which end of the political spectrum you're engaging with, or does that an argument like that resonate across the board?
It resonates across the board. What's interesting is that when you're making that argument, like you're making a law and order argument, actually flipping the argument that's been used against cannabis for so long, get tough on crime, prohibit cannabis, you flip that on and you say, get tough on crime, regulate cannabis. The latter argument stands up to scrutiny because the former argument of, you know, just say no, prohibition has failed. So if you do want to get tough on crime, if you do want to see these criminal gangs have their business model undercut, then take away a big part of their business model. And so that resonates with all sides of politics. And what we're seeing in that argument and generally when it comes to the legalised cannabis movement is very little pushback from the right of politics. The moral hand-wringing, the pearl-clutching that we'd seen in previous decades, principally led by groups like the Christian Democrats and the Reverend Fred Nile, that's gone. And a lot of these more right-wing organisations, Liberal Democrats and the Shooters Party, they recognise there's significant parts of their base that, well, the Liberal Democrats are supporting the legalisation of cannabis, but the Shooters Party as well, and even elements of One Nation, recognise that legalisation is very popular in working class, more socially conservative areas because it's a working class drug and recreation.
I think we're all looking forward to the inquiry, Jeremy, but the New South Wales Treasurer, David Mookie, has said the government, you know, it's welcomed the opportunity to hear from experts. But he's already warned that any potential policy reform would be examined at the drug summit later this year. I mean, how do you expect the inquiry and the adult use bill to play into that?
Well, I've timed it, Jonesy, to play, like, the reason we're doing it now is so that over the next 3 months we can get submissions in, we can then interrogate those, look at who we should bring into a series of hearings to occur in the July, August and September, and then with a report and recommendations going to Parliament reporting before the drug summit, which is due to be in October. So it's all designed so that we can flesh out these issues in a comprehensive way before we get to the drug summit. Because the drug summit, I for one, didn't want to see cannabis legalisation caught up in that. I think it's the drug summit will deal with a whole range of issues. And so I wanted them to be fully explored, understood and discussed outside of that. And so that's why I wanted to do the inquiry. So we have the inquiry, it delivers some recommendations, and those recommendations feed into that drug summit with more clarity, with more definition, underpinned by that comprehensive parliamentary inquiry process. So that's the strategy, is to do it now so we're taking recommendations from the inquiry into the drug summit. And it's much harder for the government to say, well, this is all news to us. We've heard X from this person, Y from that person, and then it's all mixed up in a whole range of other issues around how we deal with meth and coke and ice and medically supervised injecting rooms and all the rest. So it was a way of creating a bit of a boundary around the cannabis issue and making sure that it's fed into that process with some definition and clarity.
Yeah, that's a sound strategy, I'd say. Do you expect any meaningful proposals from the government this side of an election?
Well, I've had some the interesting thing about the Labor Party is its policies determined by their conference, and some very powerful unions have a big say in that. And I've had some very constructive conversations with some of the most powerful unions in this state about legalisation. Two, for example, the Health Services Union, the HSU, and the New South Wales Nurses and Midwives Association. Two very powerful unions, some of them affiliated with the Labor Party, who have a say in state conference. So I think that out of this inquiry, and they are making submissions to this inquiry, I think we're going to build some momentum and some pressure on the government to do something before they go to the state election. Now, they may well say we'll develop a policy position and take that to the election. I think that's already what the Premier has said. But we are a pretty significant political force here in Australian politics now, the Legalised Cannabis Party. We've gone from zero to five members in just 2 years. We're doubling our vote pretty much at every election. And who we do and don't decide to allocate preferences to could well determine some key seats at the next federal and state elections. And so in that regard, there's some pressure coming from within Labor. There's some pressure coming electorally from us for them to differentiate themselves from their current position and differentiate themselves from the coalition's position. Mm-hmm. So there's some pressure coming internally. There's already a number of Labor ministers, the Premier himself, who's argued against prohibition. There's pressure coming, and I hope that this drug summit, those unions are potentially moving, and that electoral pressure causes the government to, at the very least, take a position to the next state election in 2027 of legalising an adult use regulatory regime.
Yeah, sure.
I think it's really interesting, Jeremy, listening to you. You mentioned obviously five legalised cannabis MPs now in WA, Victoria, and yourself in New South Wales. But you're, I think, unique among those five in having previous experience as a member. That seems like that's really helpful to you because you kind of know the mechanics. You know what kind of levers to pull and how things are progressing. Is that?
Oh, yeah, look, this is not my first rodeo, as they say. I have seen how other members, and I mentioned Fred Nile previously, used a single voice in a balance of power position to get an outcome. And that political change happens slowly, but it is, as they say, like drilling through a board. Nothing seems to be happening, and all of a sudden there's a breakthrough. But that political pressure comes from a number of sources, both inside the parliament, outside of the parliament, and during elections. So you have to use all of those levers in a sort of structured, sequential way to get an outcome. Use a parliamentary process, keep the pressure on there. And look, as a member of parliament, I'm quite open to horse trading on legislation. The government needs my vote. Some parties say, well, I will never do that. That's what they say publicly, but that's bullshit. What they do is they horse trade on legislation. And I've been saying to the government, look, I need an outcome on these areas. I could jump this way or that way on a particular piece of legislation. It's no skin off my nose, but I'll support you if you give me X. And I'm using my voice, and I might only be here for one term, but I'm using my voice and my power to get the outcome for my constituents. And my constituents are those millions of Australians who use recreational cannabis, hundreds of thousands, if not millions now, of Australians who are using medicinal cannabis, and the majority of Australians who want reform in this area. So I'm there to get a job done and pull whatever levers I can in a collaborative way. I don't want to be unnecessarily adversarial, and I don't want to sell out key principles to get what I want done, but I'm determined on getting an outcome.
We might just stick with that a minute because we were going to chat to you about this a bit later, but I think it's sort of relevant to what you've just said. You know, your colleagues in Victoria, David Etchedank and Rachel Payne, were pretty unimpressed with the heavy police presence at a 420 event in Melbourne last week. And they've actually threatened to withdraw their support from the Labor government on key policy issues as a result. Now, obviously, Victoria's got two MPs. WA's got Brian Walker and Sophia Mamond. You're kind of a lone voice in New South Wales at present. Does that restrict the amount of leverage you have with the government?
Yes, it does. I mean, if there were five legalised cannabis MPs, then, yeah, we'd have more weight. But there are crucial times when the government needs my vote on legislative or procedural matters that come before, and political matters that come before the parliament. So there are key moments where the government is going to need my voice, and it's a reciprocal arrangement. I will work constructively with them if they will work constructively with me. The government knows that I've been around. I was 8 years in Parliament previously, and I was a pretty effective street campaigner, using the Parliament to build a social movement outside of the Beltway, as they call it, and that was super effective in the area around water management, the Murray-Darling Basin, coal seam gas, and moving away from fossil fuels. They were highly effective campaigns that brought about significant change and caused a lot of damage to the sitting government. Now, I can flip the dial if I wanted to, if I get no result from the government, and go on the front foot campaigning. I'd prefer not to. I'd prefer the path of least resistance, as it were, but they do know that I've got a capacity to do that. And they do know, if you look at the electoral numbers, it's highly likely, it's almost a certainty that at 2027, there'll be another legalised, if they haven't legalised cannabis, there'll be another legalised cannabis member joining me, if not two. Our 2023 result, if you add to that the momentum behind the movement, the growing party, the sort of cultural and political awareness, we only need to get another 1 or 2% more of the vote, which I think is very achievable, to elect two people in New South Wales. And the way our system works, it's half the parliament each term. That would give us three members. And that would give us an enormous amount of sway, potentially the balance of power in our own right.
Just sort of taking it forward a little bit. Obviously, German's coalition government finally got adult use reforms across the line. What can Australia's legalisation movement learn from the German experience, Jeremy?
Well, they can look at what the messaging that worked. And that was, I wasn't actually aware of it. It was actually happening at the same time as I was looking at the crime issue in New South Wales and looking at what some of our senior police had said, like the New South Wales Crime Commission, some of our senior drug squad police were saying about cutting the knees out of organised crime. And then when I was looking in that last month or so at the debate that was happening and the messaging that was coming out of Germany, what the especially the German health minister was saying was, let's attack organised crime. That's how they framed it. Let's attack organised crime, let's regulate this market and protect children. Let's make sure we bring in an adult use regulatory regime, and almost exactly the same model that the Legalised Cannabis Party in Australia has put forward, basically a homegrown and then share with your friends model, not jumping to a commercial model straight away. And that was their messaging. Let's make sure that we can educate people about the safe adult use of cannabis, make sure we protect our kids. Let's take quality control, distribution, and the profits out of the black market and organised crime. That's how they framed it. So that was incredibly useful to see coming out of Germany. The other thing too is, it's just the optics that we can learn is that there is a sophisticated, progressive, super successful nation, the largest economy in Europe, one of the most influential and powerful nations and economies in the world, deciding democratically to make this change. The first big domino to fall, as it were, in Europe. And I think there was a lot of, you know, maybe there was some reticence amongst policymakers when they look at the US especially. They go, look, you never get between, you know, an entrepreneur and a bucket of coin or a politician and a bucket of money when it came to the US. But when it came to Germany, they know that they do things in a considered way for reasons based on sound social and economic policy. Mm. And so that has given us another string to our bow. We say, well, it's not just California, you know, it's not just Canada, it's not Uruguay. I mean, Germany, super powerful economy, huge population and influence in Europe, and they're leading the way there. So that's given us a lot to learn from and to use in our advocacy.
You mentioned a domino effect there that Germany could have kick-started. I mean, do you see other countries? What other countries do you see following Germany's lead?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, you would expect that other countries, like the UK, France, would follow suit. We're seeing some of the smaller countries have already moved that way. But you would expect with the nature of their, you know, interconnected economies, their very open borders, that they're going to, the fact that Germany has become legalized is going to create issues across the EU as people move for work and for lifestyle and tourism across that area. They're going to go to Germany and say, I've been to Germany, I've come back, you know, they go there for the weekend, come back, they've got a legalized model, it works, the sky hasn't fallen in, you know, they're seeing a reduction in alcohol-related violence, they're seeing a reduction in the cost of their criminal justice system, and people are able to grow and share their own medicine and recreation, that political influence will be borne out because people will see the cultural change. Nowhere really, I mean, we've seen Thailand push back, but, you know, Thai politics is a strange, crazy beast. But nowhere really in the world have we seen anywhere go to a legalized model and then wind it back. It overwhelmingly is a success and works. And that's what we'll see in Germany. Which country is next to go? I'm sure there'll be some soon because they'll see that it works on a socio and political level. And also they'll say, well, look, there's an opportunity to create a significant revenue stream to government.
Jeremy, I just want to sort of move the conversation onto specifically medicinal cannabis for a second. And been a bit of a spate lately of kind of negative stories around, you know, in the kind of mainstream press around medicinal cannabis, and specifically, you know, Australia's two main medical bodies, the AMA and the RACGP, have, you know, suggested that telehealth services are poorly regulated and some put profits before patient care. And that sort of spilled over a little bit into some doubts around the efficacy of the medicine. Just interested, does that coverage cut through with some of your fellow MPs? Do you hear that sort of negativity reflected back at you when those stories appear?
No, not really. It's very inside baseball for a lot of people. You really have to be following it, right, Martin, to be across that. Yeah. I think at the periphery, yes, maybe some do. Some of the policy advisors, of course, working in the health and mental health and, you know, treasury areas would be keeping a weather eye on it. But I think that they see it's just the natural evolution of a regulated medicinal cannabis market, that there's regulations, there's enforcement, there's a range of different corporate players in there pushing the boundaries in some areas, some crossing the line, some not, and the various regulatory bodies responding. I don't think, though, that that's pushing over into any sort of serious questioning of whether or not medicinal cannabis is a legitimate therapy for a range of serious ailments and health issues people have. I think that that isn't the situation now, but I think there is a potential for the cannabis industry has to think about that, is that that could come into question. If they push too hard and turn a medicinal cannabis industry into a faux recreational market and, you know, push the boundaries on advertising and don't maintain the integrity of that, especially that doctor-patient interface, then those questions could arise down the track, especially as the industry grows.
Right, yeah. Interesting. Not specifically related to medicinal cannabis, but there was something that you've been working on lately, which is in light of the terrible events that happened at Bondi Junction recently, which was the introduction of a payroll levy on the state's largest employers to reverse a slide in mental health funding, which is something that's already happening in Victoria and Queensland. I thought it was interesting because you have to have a position on a bunch of things, not just medicinal cannabis. What sort of response did you get from the government? Do you think, is that a proposal that's likely to be included in the upcoming budget?
I'm not sure. I think that I made a submission to what's called the Expenditure Review Committee. One of the things that I've made the case about in terms of whatever model we've got for regulating cannabis is, I think that you'll win a lot of community support if we make the argument that we'll regulate it, we'll generate revenue, and we hypothecate that revenue into reducing the harms of drugs generally and putting it into mental health services, making sure that that revenue goes into the regulation of the industry itself. So in making that case about cannabis, I was looking at the data on mental health, because I'm always keeping an eye on that, and seeing that New South Wales is a real laggard when it comes to the amount per capita we're putting into mental health, that we mental health accounts for about 15% of the disease load in New South Wales, but only about 5% of the funding. We're way behind the other states in our per capita funding. And so we need to find ways to generate that revenue. As I said, I've always argued that if we go to a commercial model, regulated and taxed adult use cannabis market, that money should be hypothecated into health, mental health. And I also think that we should be finding a novel ways to generate revenue for mental health generally. And the payroll tax has been brought in Victoria and Queensland, well received there, both by the companies paying the tax, because, you know, it's their employees that are suffering from these mental health burdens themselves, making sure there's the services there. That's a good use of their tax dollars. And it's been well received by the community and generating billions in revenue. And I think that when we look at things like online gambling, the other suggestion I had was that a point of consumption tax for online gambling, you know, so you tax the bad, or you tax, as they call it, the sin taxes, you take that and make sure it goes into reducing the cost of online gambling on the community. That's a good use of those tax dollars. So it's an area I think we have to get involved in, how we generate the revenue and making sure it goes into those critical areas.
Okay, great. Well, we are going to have to leave it in a minute. But before we do, any plans for Mardi Gras? Jeremy, are you heading up to Nimbin this weekend?
Yes, I'm going up to Mardi Gras. I'm just going to try and not get too stoned. It's very hard up there. The air is just full of smoke and there's just the vibe. It's an intoxicating event. But, I'm really looking forward to catching up with my legalised cannabis party colleagues from around the country, both the elected members and some of our activists, and looking at, you know, we are the legalised cannabis party, but once we're electing people, there are some other areas we have to get involved in, and there's some big issues on the table. What are some of the ideas we have about reducing domestic violence? You know, could cannabis play a role in creating an alternative to, you know, at like rampant alcohol consumption in this country? You know, would that impact on DV rates? I think it would. You know, how do we reduce violence in our society? How do we fund mental health? So there's these great ideas that I think a lot of people in the cannabis movement have because of their expertise that are applicable and just adjacent to the areas that we're working on. So I'm looking forward to catching up with all the crew, listening to what's been happening in other states, and especially also focusing on the hemp issue. There's been a lot of movement in that area around the country. The barriers to that, the development of the industrial hemp industry in this state and other states are really coming down. So I'm really looking forward to hearing about how those other jurisdictions are moving forward on the cannabis industry, the adult use cannabis, medicinal cannabis, the RDT issue, and hemp. So there's a lot for us to talk about, and we'll do that over a spliff or two in Nimbin on the weekend.
Now, you're making me very jealous. It just leaves me to thank Jonesy.
Thank you.
Jeremy, thanks very much for your insights and everything you do.
No, I really appreciate talking to you guys and really appreciate the work you guys do with cannabis. It's a font of wisdom and information. It really does help to have that journal there, which people can go to and find out what's happening in a really comprehensive and contemporary way. So I really appreciate the work you're doing.
No, thank you.
We'll see you next time on the Cannabis Podcast.